Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
Liam, good evening. How are you, mate?
Awesome, Matt. Really good. You know, end of school holidays.
Oh, yeah? That's good.
Looking forward to tomorrow, actually, getting back to work.
Right. You haven't been off work?
No.
But you're looking forward to your kids getting back to work?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, when you're working from home and there's always background noise and there's a few things going on, that'd be good to get back to work. Get the kids back to school, I should say.
Yeah, that's pretty much my life.
Yeah, you won't be far off school. Well, your second node's going to take a while, but I think Riley's not
second.
Far off school.
Second node has some scaling up to do.
Yeah. Gosh, how far can we drag that drag that analogy?
Yeah, it's gonna be going for a while, isn't it?
Yes. Gosh. So we were just talking, Matt, and just sort of reminiscing on how we've had a lack of technical content recently.
Yeah, we have. Let's get technical.
Let's get technical. So I know there's something that you've wanted to talk about and something that you've actually done a talk about before, and you've done, I think, one or two talks about in the past, is auth. Authentication, yes. Authorization. So we'll just abbreviate that to auth.
Yeah.
And then I asked you, what specifically did you want to talk about auth? And what did you say?
All of it. I want to talk about, right, is because I think everyone knows what auth is. Not everyone. Most people know what auth is. Some people have a good understanding of it. Some people have a very deep and thorough understanding of it. And for a lot of people, it's kind of this scary black box. So I want to demystify it a bit. I want to talk about auth from a conceptual level. Yeah, we can get a little bit technical, but I mean, it is a technical topic, but I want to talk about it. I guess I want to explain or ask a question. What do you know about auth? Like, what do you know about how it works, what it is? And let's talk about it and let's explain it and let's see if it's as scary as some people think it is.
What do I know about auth? Aside from sort of the standard consumer side where we're logging in and username, passwords, multi-factor, et cetera, there's obviously, as I said earlier, with auth is sort of encompassing both authentication and authorization.
That's right, yeah.
Which from a beginner's mindset, that's a tough distinction to make.
Yes.
I remember way back when I was early in my career, you'd sort of throw those two terms together and just assume that they were the same thing.
Yep.
But crucially, as we know, they're not. And I think I remember a talk you did gave a really good example of that.
Yeah.
And that example was the driver's license.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right. So you can use your driver's license as a form of identification.
Yep.
Which is your authentication. This is who I am.
Yes.
But the driver's license itself contains what restrictions and what you're allowed to drive or ride if it's a motorcycle.
Yeah.
And that's the authorization aspect.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that's a really clear, concise analogy that drives at home that big difference between authentication and authorization.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm glad that hit home. I think it's a good explanation. So authentication is proving who you are. Authorization is what you're allowed to do.
Yep. And I think that's a great place to start, right? Especially from a beginner's mindset. Like I said, that can be quite confusing.
Yeah.
And then, look, as we've said, you and I are both from, say, the .NET background.
Yep.
And then from there, I always remember, it's file new project, and then there's the checkbox, do you want to add authentication? Select the drop-down, Microsoft or corporate account, is it? And then
intranet applications.
Intranet applications, or then you've got individual accounts. You pick the flavor of authorization and authentication you want.
Yeah.
So then that's the second introduction.
Yeah.
The second level introduction. And then I remember the third, for me personally, was going back, can't remember now, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, when the Microsoft templates were using Identity Server.
Yep.
And then that's when I really sort of started to play around and dig in with authentication. And at that point is when it all gets confusing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's dive into that and dissect it. Well, let's take a step back, right? I'm going to park authorization for now. And I just want to talk about authentication. Okay. So authentication is proving that you are who you say you are, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I go up to a computer or a website and I type in the username. That's me saying who I am, right? So I put in the username, which might be Matt Goldman or matt.goldman@mycompany.com or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's me asserting who I am. But then I need to prove I am who I say I am, right? So I put in a password, and that is supposedly me proving that I am who I say I am. Now, yep. I'm gonna take a very quick tangent very quickly. I'm going to come right back, which is that passwords are not fit for purpose. And this is another talk that I did when I talked about, well, what are we doing instead of passwords? And the answer is quite a lot, but we're not getting rid of passwords just yet, because we still need them for various reasons that we'll actually get to. But passwords on their own are not fit for purpose. They are problematic for many reasons. But we'll come back to that, right? But essentially, what we're saying is that I am proving that I am who I say I am, and who I say I am is the username, and how I'm proving it is with the password. But let's take a step back again from passwords, and let's talk about this concept of proving that you are who you say you are.
Mm-hmm.
This is done traditionally by one of three ways, well, by one of two ways, and not necessarily so recently, but now modern times a third way as well. So those three ways are something you know, something you have, or something you are. So mm-hmm. to just break those down, something you know might be a password or a mm-hmm. secret of some kind that is known only to you. That's yep. how you prove that you are who you say you are, because no one else knows that secret, because you absolutely don't share your passwords with other people. And, you know,
and you never reuse them.
You never reuse them, and they're never in a breach.
Yep. In a perfect so, world.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons passwords are not fit for purpose. And to be honest, one of the minor ones. So something you know, a secret, right? Something you have. Okay. So something you have might be a dongle. So back mm-hmm. in the day, like even before the modern internet, you might prove that you are who you say you are by physically plugging a dongle into a computer. And this is even pre-USB. Dongles, serial dongles have been around for decades, right? So that might be another way of proving that you are who you say you are, something you have. More modern times, something you have might be a passkey.
Yep.
Or what we now call a roaming authenticator, which we can get back to that as well. Or it could be a physical or virtual token, one-time token generator. So again, something else that's been around for decades is these RSA tokens.
Mm.
Do you ever the football they used to call it? Yeah.
The dongles you got from the bank.
Yeah. So your bank would yeah. give you a little key ring with 6-digit number on it that would change every 30 seconds. Yeah. That number is generated using something called the RSA algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's generated from a specific key, which is associated with you. And therefore, so these passwords are unique and they're one time. So these codes, they regenerate every 30 seconds, and they are deterministic, right? So they're generated by an algorithm. So if you know the key and you know the way that it's generated, you can determine what that number should be, what that code should be at any given point in time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have given, so now we all have software authenticators on our phones, but it used to be the key ring that your bank gave you, right?
Yep.
So something you know, something you have, right? So we're now talking about two different factors of authentication, hence the term multi-factor or two-factor authentication.
Mm-hmm.
Another something you have might be your phone. So SMS, right? So they can send you an SMS as a second factor.
Yep.
Yeah.
I can see you screwing up
your phones. Sorry?
Arguably, that's not as secure.
Yeah, correct. So yes, arguably, although that, again, that's a whole other topic. It's quite hotly, even though SMS is absolutely not secure, it's not a secure technology, there are plenty of people arguing why using it for a second factor is still secure, even though the medium itself is not. But that's a whole other topic. But either way, whether or not these things individually are secure or not is neither here nor there. So we're talking about something you know
mm-hmm.
or something you have. Now, the most recent one that's become a trend is something you are. So something you are is biometrics.
Yep.
So biometrics is things like fingerprint, face recognition, eye recognition. One of the ones that's gaining huge popularity in very secure environments like enterprises, hospitals, defense, is this palm vein scanning. So what this does is you put your hand on a scanner and using infrared, it scans the veins in your palm and basically instantly generates a 3D model of the blood vessels in your palm.
Yep.
And these are about 1 million times more unique than a fingerprint.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So yeah, depends how far you want to take it, right? There's lots of other things as well. There's some really interesting research in this area, and this is a bit of a tangent that I'm going to waffle on for a moment because it's quite interesting. But there was this research that was done that was conducted into. They basically created a game, a typing game that's like Guitar Hero, right? So you're seeing things happen on screen, and you've got to press keys in response to it, basically.
Yep.
And you play this for 60 seconds, and the way that you respond is so individually unique that they can identify people within an infinitesimal fraction of, you know, 100% perfect, right?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
You know what's even more interesting?
What's that?
Is the people that wrote the paper on this described it as being impervious to what they call rubber hose attacks.
Never heard of a rubber hose attack.
Yeah. So the term rubber hose attack is a term given to basically someone that was interrogated and asked for a password and refused to give it and then was beaten with a rubber hose until he handed it over. So this particular system could identify... Well, I was going to say it could identify that you are under duress, but that's not the case, right? But the way that you respond to this test is so unique that if you are stressed or under duress, the way that you respond is different enough that you don't pass the authentication, thus making it impervious to rubber hose attacks or coercion or duress, right?
Yep.
So I thought that was interesting. And that's also something that you are, right? Because it can't be replicated. Yeah. There's other things as well, which can be, right? So, well, I mean, so if you talk about facial recognition, we also saw those articles about someone printing out a picture of someone's face and holding it up to the phone and that unlocked it. Voice print stuff is easy to forge.
Mm-hmm.
Even fingerprints. So when we talk about multi-factor authentication, a lot of what we think about biometrics for is convenience, right? So I unlock my phone and my computer with a fingerprint or a face so that I don't have to put my password in. But really, if you want to be secure, it should be multi-factor, not different factor. Anyway, we're going way off topic, right? So we're talking about explaining authentication is the process of proving that you are who you say you are through something you know, something you have, or something you are.
Or both, or more than one.
Or some combination thereof. Yep. Yeah. Well, how does that work in a modern application? Like, let's say, a web app.
Well, we sign in.
Yep.
And then it depends, I guess, on the style of application, right?
To a point, yes. Yep.
Is it a single page app or is it a server-ended app?
Yep.
I guess the flavor of the month, and as it has been for the last several years, being a single page app, once we've authenticated, we end up with a token.
Yep.
Right, a signed token that basically from an authority that says you have authenticated against me. I'm happy. I've signed it, like the driver's license. I say you are who you say you are.
Yeah. Okay. There's a lot of words there that you used that probably need some explanation. But before we get onto those, I think it's really interesting that you basically said, so we sign in, and then you just moved on from that part.
Yep.
Because you're right. Because everything that we've just spoken about is the signing in part. And that's it. That's the first step. Like literally all that stuff we've just described is literally just the first step. Once you've signed in, you've still got to do something else. So you're talking about the modern flavor, which it has been for a few years. And what I'm assuming that you're going to say is that the way before that was cookies, right?
Yep.
The cookies haven't gone away.
No, and that's why I made the differentiation between single page apps or server rendered apps, right?
Yeah.
Because if you're working on a server-rendered app, I guess you're still looking towards cookie auth, right?
Yes. Yes and no. And yes, and it depends.
And it depends.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk about cookies a bit more because there's generally a belief that we have moved on from cookies and that we're using tokens, as you called them. And I think let's go with a simplistic approach first. Let's talk about your... I think you said server rendered application. So server side app. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about cookies and let's talk about that first, right? So we hear about cookies all the time, right? And because of GDPR, we go on any website now and we get a great big banner saying, do you accept cookies? And people think cookies are something scary or something mystical or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And don't know what they do, what they are, apart from the fact that they let Facebook spy on you steal your data. You get ads based on, like, everyone's talking about the surveillance. We've spoken about it before. You know, everyone knows exactly what you're doing on the internet, where you're going, what you're looking at, and it's all because of cookies.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, that's kind of one type of cookie.
Yeah.
And that's called a tracking cookie.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, the term cookie itself comes from magic cookie, which is an older computer term, which I believe is, I should know this, but I believe it is a term for a piece of code or data that is like a cure-all kind of panacea type thing. I should look that up. But a cookie in terms of a browser cookie, which is what we're talking about, is essentially it's a piece of data that a website sends to your browser.
Yep.
Now, in terms of authentication, an authentication cookie, which is distinct from a tracking cookie, and again, like just to reiterate, a cookie is basically a piece of data that a website has given your browser, right? And that's it.
Yeah.
So an authentication cookie is if you are running a server-rendered application, and maybe we should talk about what that means as well for a second, right? So with a server-rendered application, you open your browser and you put in an address and the server generates a page and sends it to your browser and your browser renders it, right?
Mm.
With a single page application, which is a huge misnomer, but with a single page application, an entire application is downloaded into your browser rather than the pages being generated on the server. The pages are already in your browser and the single page application exchanges data with the server, yeah, and is already built in a specific way to render that data.
Yes. So I guess the big difference there is you don't have server state.
Yeah. I mean, you might actually.
But
yes, I mean, but ostensibly, yes. I mean, if you're interacting with a REST API that is 100% RESTful,
yeah,
and you have a single page application, then yes, your server does not have any state. You're just exchanging data with a server. Mm. You don't even need to do that actually with a, you know, single page application doesn't necessarily have to have a back end, but let's assume it does, right? Because we're talking about auth and we'll come back to why that's relevant. But yeah, you either have the whole application in your browser and your browser just renders what you want to look at using data from a back end, or you don't have the whole application in your browser. You just have one page at a time that you're looking at.
Yeah.
And the server has those pages and sends you the one you want to see.
Yep.
So let's talk about
the data you want to see on it.
Yeah. Yeah. So the data is already in the page when you get the page.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say the server has protected data on it. So you go to the server, you sign in, you prove that you are who you say you are, either mm-hmm. something you know, something you have, or something you are, or some combination thereof. And we'll come back to those and the mechanisms of how those things work a bit later on. So you've signed in, right? And now you don't want to have to do that every page you go to. Right. Sure. So you don't log in. And then when you click on a link and go to another page, you don't log in again and log in for every single page. And by the way, that is something that they used to do back with the old HT access files. So with an HT access file, you would basically put it in every folder that you wanted to protect. So anytime you tried to navigate to a page,
yeah,
in a folder or a directory on the web server that had an HT access file, you had to authenticate again.
Mm.
So we kind of solved that problem with cookies, right? So you go to the server, you sign in, and the server returns your web page and gives your browser a cookie, an authentication cookie.
Yep.
Now, the way that a cookie works is that it is sent to the server along with every request automatically, right? So these authentication cookies are typically what is referred to as a session cookie, because as you said, typically these applications are stateful. They're stateful, right?
Yes.
So the server has in memory a session that represents you, the user, or your session.
Mm-hmm.
So you log in and every request that you send to the browser has that cookie sent along with it. The application receives that cookie, reads it, and says, yes, I have a valid session corresponding to Liam. Liam has authenticated. Liam is logged in, has a session. Therefore, I can return the page that he's asking for. The caveat being if he is authorized to view it.
Yes.
We're going to come back to authorization. Okay. Yep. So that's basically how cookies work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why does that not work with a single page application?
I've never thought about that. I've just utilized JWT tokens, auth tokens, because I guess that's the way things are at the moment. But I've never really thought, why would I not use an auth cookie?
Mm. The answer is that you can, and we're going to come back to that. But generally, you don't for this reason, right? Now, what we've just described with a server-rendered application is kind of a very single standalone application type scenario.
Mm-hmm.
But what we have now and what we expect now is something we call single sign-on.
Yep.
Okay. So single sign-on means that you have one set of credentials or one quote-unquote identity. So the identity, I guess, is a combination of, well, the identity is I guess, the conceptual thing that represents you. Okay. So single sign-on, you might have a Google account and you might be able to log into Figma.
Yep.
You might be able to log into Canva. You might be able to log into Miro or myriad other applications using.
And that's where on the login screens, these days we see sign in with my Google account, sign in with Microsoft account, et cetera, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's single sign on Facebook, Twitter, what have you, or your corporate enterprise account, what have you.
Yep.
So in fact, even back before all the common stuff we're talking about now, so back when I used to look after enterprise IT systems, we would have single sign on with Active Directory. So on premises, our identity was in Active Directory, and then other applications would come and enterprise applications would be installed into our enterprise network in our workplace, and we would configure them for single sign-on, which means that people would use the same account that they use to log into their computer to log into these applications.
Yep.
And that was typically using a protocol called LDAP.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't go into that now. That's kind of, it's not ancient history, but it's off topic of what we're talking about. Now, single sign-on, historically, I don't see it happen so much, but I often used to see it get confused with pass-through authentication or automatic authentication, where people would think it means that, well, when I've logged in, I don't want to have to log into all my other applications again. I should automatically be logged into those. That's pass-through authentication, which is distinct from single sign-on. Single sign-on means I have one identity that I use to access multiple things.
Yep.
So going back to our application, right? So in our server rendered application, and the same is potentially true here for a server rendered and a single page application. In order to have single sign-on, you need to have a single source of truth for that identity. So if you choose to sign in with Google, Google is the source of truth for your identity. If you choose to sign in with Microsoft, Microsoft is the source of truth for your identity. There's a word that you used earlier when you were describing the process, and that is authority.
Yep.
So in authentication parlance, we've got another auth now in the mix, which is authority.
Authority, yep.
Yeah. So what you described earlier is specifically something called OAuth, which is the modern technique used by pretty much everyone. It's not the only game in town, but it is, you know, the most common one. And OAuth is kind of a core standard, and it's a fairly non-prescriptive standard for stateless authentication. Mm-hmm. So stateless versus stateful means that there has to be a session in memory on the server that you're accessing that says, I know that this session, and identify the session via a cookie, corresponds to Liam, and I know that Liam is who he says he is, right?
Yep.
If you want it to be stateless, you need a way of identifying that a request that comes in is valid, right? So a request comes from you, and I don't have a session that represents you or corresponds to you, and that request says, hey, this request is from Liam. I need a way of saying, well, how do I know that? And we do that with a token.
Yep.
And OAuth, and this is kind of what OAuth describes. Now, something called OpenID Connect, which is an extension of OAuth, it builds on top of OAuth, right? And basically, it's way more prescriptive than OAuth. And by being prescriptive, because OAuth on itself, or OAuth 2, I should say, because that's kind of the current standard, it's pretty conceptual, right? So it says that you use tokens to, you know, identify requests. It doesn't say what those tokens should look like or how they should work.
Yeah.
And it says very little else. OIDC, or OpenID Connect, is, as I said, an extension for OAuth, and it's very prescriptive. And it says, not only does it say use tokens, but it says use JWTs, JSON Web Tokens.
Yeah, okay.
And we'll talk about what those are. It also prescribes some standard ways of operating that allow different systems that comply with OIDC to interoperate. And that's how you're enabled to have single sign-on through multiple different applications. Because it's a very strictly defined standard, anyone can implement it, and anyone can trust an authority. And there's two important words there, which means that someone that's using an identity that is owned by that authority can then access that system.
Yep.
So let's break these things down a bit, and let's talk a little bit about how it works. So an authority publishes a document called a discovery document. It's a JSON metadata file at a known address, which is defined in OIDC. So it's /.well-known/openid-configuration. So any open OIDC authority must publish a metadata discovery document at this address. That metadata discovery document contains a bunch of information. One of those pieces of information is where to find its signing keys, or its public keys, I should say, right? Yep. So it's got public keys available, and it says, here are my public keys. Any token that someone presents to you that they claim has been issued by me will be signed by a private key corresponding to one of the public keys published at these addresses.
Yep.
So that is how you are able to interoperate, and that is how single sign-on can work. That is how all these different applications can trust this identity, because when you configure your application, as you rightly described it, you specify an authority.
Yeah.
Or multiple, right? But you basically say, I'm going to trust tokens issued by this authority.
Yep.
Okay. So let's talk through your process again and talk about what happens in the context of that. So what actually happens here is you go to your application, call it, you know, mattspizza.com, whatever, and you click sign in. You never give your username and password to mattspizza.com.
Yeah.
What actually happens is you're redirected to the authority.
Yep.
You get to the authority, you enter your username and password in their web page, which gets sent across the wire to the authority, but never via my application. So my application never has to handle your credentials.
Yeah.
But the authority then issues you a cookie. So you still have your cookie, right? And that means that when I then go and click on log in on Liam's Pizza and I get redirected to my authority, I already have a cookie, so I don't have to log in again.
Yeah.
I'm already logged in. So let's talk about what happens then. So whether you already logged in or not, you click log in on the pizza website, you get redirected to the authority, you enter your credentials or not if you already have a cookie. Then what happens is, now there's variations on how this can work, but I'm going to talk about basically how it works as standard now, the modern way of doing things, which is something called the authorization code flow with proof key for certificate exchange, or otherwise known as PKCE or PKCE,
yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Proof key for code exchange, sorry. So you log in and then you are redirected back to the original application, which in OIDC is called the relying party. So that's my website, my pizza website. And in the redirect URL, there are some query parameters. One of them will be a state parameter, and that represents back to my application who that represents. And in fact, let's talk about that for a second. So let's say I go onto the pizza website and I order 10 pizzas. I put them in my cart. Mm-hmm. I'm not logged in, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, but yeah, I've got 10 pizzas in my cart. I've put in a whole bunch of other information. Then I click log in. So I'm redirected somewhere else and it's, mm-hmm. it's stateless, right? There's no session. Okay.
Yep.
So then I come back from the authority back to the relying party, the application that's called it, and I get a state token. And that state token allows me to rehydrate that original session locally. So normally what your application would do, your single page application, is it takes all that data. Instead of sending it to a server, it caches it in local storage, right? And it gives it a key, and that key will basically be accessible via that state parameter. Kind of glossing over here, but
yep.
So and that allows me to rehydrate the state. But the main thing that's important from the auth perspective is the other thing that it gives me is an authorization code. So I click login, I go to my authority, I come back after I've signed in and I've proved that I am who I say I am. I come back with something called an authorization code. My application can now call the authority's token issuing endpoint with that code.
Mm-hmm.
And receive my tokens in exchange for it.
So you don't get the token back. You get an authorization. Did you call it an authorization token or an authorization
code? Yeah.
That you can use to request your specific token.
Yeah. So there used to be something called the implicit grant. Mm-hmm. And the implicit grant, when you sign in, you're redirected with your tokens as query parameters.
Yep.
But that's not secure, because that is susceptible to all kinds of attacks, right? Aside from the fact that it's in plain human readable text and URL, puts you at risk of all kinds of man in the middle attacks. So that's why we do what's called the proof key for code exchange instead now. So you come back with, instead of coming back with the tokens, you come back with an authorization code. And the authorization code is used to request those tokens from the token issuing endpoint of the authority.
Yeah, okay.
You with me so far?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So
I think
I'll just go through it again. So you go to the pizza website, you click uh-huh. it, you click login, and that redirects you to the authority.
Yep.
You sign in at the authority. The authority says, yep, all good, sends you back with an authorization code. That authorization code is then exchanged for your tokens.
So how is that protected against a man-in-the-middle attack?
Because, I'm glad you asked, right? So the reason it's protected from a man-in-the-middle attack is that on your authority, you will configure certain clients. Okay. So in fact, let's talk about the concept of resources in OIDC for a second. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as OIDC is concerned, everything's a resource. A user is a resource. A protected API is a resource. A client, which is a relying party application, is a resource.
Yep.
So client application might be an end user facing application. An API resource is a protected resource that needs a token to access. So your client configuration will say something like, these are the scopes that a user is allowed to ask for. A mm-hmm. scope is used to identify an API resource.
Yep.
A scope is basically a string of text. You know, it can be anything, right? And a scope the scopes can represent different things. So there are some standard scopes like OpenID, profile, and email. They're standard scopes, right? There's another one called offline access. And if you request the offline access scope, you'll also get something called a refresh token, which we'll come back to in a minute. But then you would also specify a scope that represents an API resource. So that then tells the authority how to issue the token. And I'm going to come back to that as well. But just getting back to your question, a client configuration in the authority will have certain restrictions on it. Like this is the redirect URI that's allowed to be called.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I set up Matt's Pizza as an authorized application, an authorized redirect URI in a client configuration on my authority. And then I go to liamspizza.com and I click login and I try and get to my authority, and I haven't configured liamspizza.com on that authority, I'll get an invalid client configuration error. Okay. Now, there is still the potential of man in the middle attacks around that. You can spoof addresses. But the other thing that it does is cause, right? It configures cause.
Yep.
So if I've got those,
just to cover that, cause cross-origin resource sourcing, is it? Sharing?
Yes.
Resource sharing?
It's sharing. I think it's sharing.
Resource sharing,
I think it's cross-origin resource sharing,
Requests.
Okay. So what is cause and what does it do? Basically, it's annoying and it breaks things in a nutshell.
And then everyone turns it on to just accept all from everywhere.
Yeah, which is just pointless.
Which defeats the purpose.
It does, yeah. Look, cause is very, very, it's so annoying because it doesn't, it's not, let's not go, that's a whole, let's do a rant episode on that in the future. But it is very important, and it basically, especially with the proliferation of single page applications, it's crucial, right? It's absolutely crucial,
absolutely.
Right? What it means is when you've got same origin, and let's say you have your server rendered application, but not only that, there's other circumstances as well. Let's say you have your server rendered application. So I go to liamspizza.com. Liamspizza.com gives me a web page, and that web page makes a request of the server. That's the same origin.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
But let's say it's a single page application, and the single page application UI is at liamspizza.com, and that is calling a backend at api.liamspizza.com. That's a different origin.
Yeah.
So without cause, right, that's just not allowed.
Yep.
What cause does is cause lets you specify allowed origins.
Sure.
And other things like what methods and what headers are allowed as well.
Sure.
So getting back to authentication and my authority and how this works with the authorization code and what makes it a bit more secure is, so if you've got the tokens in the redirect URL and the redirect URL is intercepted, then someone's got those tokens, right?
Absolutely.
But if all they've got is the code and they intercept the code, they can only call that from an allowed origin, which is supposedly what makes it more secure, right? So if I log in from liamspizza.com and I somehow intercept the redirect URL and I get the code and I try and use that code to obtain a token from the token issuing endpoint of the authority from matspizza.com, that's going to fail.
Okay. So in a nutshell, the authorization code on its own is useless, and I can only actually use it if I'm calling from a point that I'm allowed to be calling from.
Yes. Now, there's more to it than that, right? Because not only is it a point you're allowed to be calling from. So remember I said that there are specific client configurations?
Yep.
So you can specify multiple different clients, and it's not just any allowed origin that the authority allows. It's an allowed origin that the authority allows for that client, right?
Yeah, okay.
So if it's configured for Liam's Pizza, it has to come from Liam's Pizza, even if Matt's Pizza is also supported. If that's not the same client, it's not going to work.
Sure.
Right? And if it's not for the right authorized scopes and everything else. Okay. So, you know, they're doing as much as they can.
Well, and that explains how that's a lot more secure than just spitting back out the token on its own.
Exactly. Right. Okay. So we now understand that you go to matspizza.com or liamspizza.com, you click login, you go to the authority, you authenticate, you sign in, you prove that you are who you say you are. You're redirected back to the browser, in your browser, to liamspizza.com or matspizza.com with an authorization code. And that authorization code is then sent back to the authority, to the token endpoint, and you get tokens back.
Yep.
Let's talk about those tokens.
So traditionally, they're JSON Web Tokens, JWTs.
Not just traditionally, but in OIDC, they are mandated to be.
Okay.
Well, not the refresh token. That's a whole different thing. But the other tokens, Now, those tokens are, there's two main types of tokens. So there's the refresh token, which we'll come to. But the other two main types of token are the ID token and the access token.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they are different in that an access token is used to access the protected API resource, and the identity token contains information about the user resource,
otherwise known as claims.
So, yes. So claims is how... So let's talk about a JSON Web Token and what it is, right?
Sure.
So a JSON Web Token, so JSON is, you know, standard for representing objects on the web.
Yep.
JavaScript object notation, that's what it stands for.
Mm-hmm.
A JSON Web Token, a JWT JSON Web Token, is made up of three parts.
a header, a payload, and a signature.
Yep.
Okay. The header contains information about how the token is constructed and what signing algorithm is used.
Mm-hmm.
The payload contains the data.
Yep.
And the signature is the signature and is used for validating it. And I'll talk about that in a moment.
Sure.
Now, the payload is made up of what's called claims, as you said. So claims are key value pairs in JSON, where, you know, the key is a key and the value is the data, right?
Sure.
So identity token claims might be things like username, email address,
mm-hmm.
right? Access token claims might contain things like expiry. And critically, it will contain a claim called audience.
Yes.
Okay. We'll come to those in a moment, but I just want to talk about this signing thing for a second, because this is a really important part. Do you know what signing is?
I believe I do.
Okay.
I just cover all my bases there, just in case you stand to correct me. But with the, what is it, with the public key cryptography, right? So yep. I've got my private key or public private key cryptography. I've got my private key and a public key.
Yeah.
Right? So if I want to publish any documents or anything, I can sign that with my private key.
Yes.
And provided my public key, anyone can access my public key, that's fine. But because I'm the only one that knows my private key, anyone can use my public key to verify my signature.
Yeah.
To verify that the content of that document has not been altered.
In a nutshell, yes. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So we're talking about PKI, public key infrastructure. It's what's called asymmetric encryption.
Yep.
So as you said, you've got a public key and a private key, and both of those keys can be used to encrypt data.
Mm-hmm.
And you can encrypt data with the public key, and then the private key can decrypt it. And that is how basically data is sent securely to a web server.
But only the private key can decrypt it.
That's correct.
Right. You can't decrypt it with the public key.
That's exactly 100% correct.
Yep.
So one key is used to lock it. The other key is to unlock it.
Yep.
But it goes the other way, right? So you can encrypt something with the private key that can be decrypted with the public key.
Yep.
Right. The difference is, the reason it's asymmetric is that the public key can actually be derived from the private key. So if you've got the private key, you can essentially solve an equation to get the public key from that.
Yeah. Okay.
But you can't do it the other way around.
Yep.
And I won't go into the maths of how that works right now, but I am planning a video on it, and it's actually quite straightforward. I do it with very small numbers just to demonstrate how it works. So keep an eye out for that. So yes. So the way that signing works, so essentially, right, with your JSON web token, you want to validate that. And also, actually, so another important point is JSON web tokens are not encrypted. They're signed, right?
Yeah.
So you don't put sensitive data in your JSON web tokens. You absolutely do not, right? Because it's humanly readable. It's just JSON, right? It's just text. It's key value pairs. What the signature does is two things. Is one, it proves that it has been issued by an authority that you trust.
Yep.
And two, it proves that it hasn't been tampered with.
Yeah.
So a common thing that people do is put roles in their token.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to know that you can trust that token, because otherwise it's a trivial attack to add an admin role to your token.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you can prove that's not authentic, because the signature allows you to validate that it hasn't been tampered with.
Sure.
So typically you would encrypt something, and you would say, here's the encrypted version and here's how I encrypted it. And here are the steps. And then if you encrypt them in exactly the same way, you'll get the same result, right?
Yeah.
Now, this works actually the other way around, right? What it does is it says, here's how this was encrypted. You actually can't re-encrypt this and get back to this, because
you don't have the private key.
You don't have the private key. But what you can do is you can follow these steps to, if I show you the steps and I say, this is how I encrypted it. And there's some important things here, right? So one of the things is you say, here's the algorithm that I used to encrypt it. Another thing you do is you say, here's the padding, right? And you say, here's the steps that I took to get to this encrypted payload. And that's what a signature is, right? So you can then decrypt that, and then you can validate that the decrypted contents match exactly what the steps that they said they took to encrypt it, which includes your original payload plus whatever padding. So you actually, as I said, you do it. So it's the reverse of what you do with passwords, right? Where you hash it and you compare the hashes.
Yep.
You actually decrypt it, and then you validate that the decrypted content matches, you know, what you've got as your payload.
Okay. Yep. Okay.
So, and you can then also, because you've got the public key, you can validate that it was in fact encrypted with the private key that corresponds to that public key, right? So that's how signing works in a nutshell, which may be a bit too in-depth, but it's kind of important, I think. So we've got our tokens. So the authority returns an identity token and an access token. Both of these are signed. So we know that A, they haven't been tampered with, and B, they were issued by the authority that we trust. So we're all comfortable with that right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those tokens correspond to different scopes. You're remembering earlier I said that when you sign in, I didn't actually say this, but when you sign in, you request a scope or a series of scopes.
Yeah, you didn't say you request it, but you did mention authorization side, I think it was, that you could be authorized to access certain scopes, I think.
I don't think I did, but actually that's right. So from an OAuth perspective, that's how OAuth. So OAuth is technically a quote-unquote an authorization protocol, not just an authentication protocol,
mm-hmm.
Because a user can be authorized to access different scopes. In reality, that means that you are authorized to access application A's backend or application B's backend. Authorization within those resources itself is not within the scope of what OAuth does.
Sure.
So that might mean that you are, from an OAuth perspective, it might, you know, control whether you're authorized to access Matt's Pizza or Liam's Pizza, but it has nothing to do with what roles or permissions you have within Matt's Pizza or Liam's Pizza. But that's off topic, right? So I did mention scopes, and I said that scopes correspond to different resources, and they can be API resources, they can be user resources. But I did fail to mention that part of that sign-in request, when I click the button on one of our pizza websites and I go to the authority, part of that request includes the scopes that I'm asking for. And I mentioned some of the standard scopes like profile, OpenID, and offline access.
Mm-hmm.
So if you request the profile scope, you get the ID token. Now, many identity providers now will just return the ID token anyway, or it's configurable to say always return the ID token.
Yep.
Okay. You can also, in some cases, return user claims within the access token as well. And that's kind of valid sometimes because you want to send that information along to the back end, and you're not supposed to send your ID token to your back end. So the ID token is purely for your front end, and the access token is what your front end sends to the back end. And that's the bit that we're coming up to, right? So your profile scope results in an ID token.
Mm-hmm.
And then do you remember when I said that a scope represents an API resource?
Yes.
So if you don't request a scope that corresponds to an API resource, you're not going to get an access token, because an access token is specifically...
You're not requesting access, yeah.
Exactly. An access token is specifically for accessing an API resource.
Yep.
So you request a scope that corresponds to an access to an API resource, and your authority issues you a token that's valid for accessing that API resource. How is it validated as being for that specific API resource? Is through the audience claim. So do you remember I said that earlier?
Yeah.
There's a claim on the access token called audience. So the audience represents the specific API resource that that token is intended for. Now, there's different ways of configuring that. So the specific how you do that is kind of not prescriptive. Technically, it would be a client ID it's a resource ID that represents that API resource. I'm not going to go too much into that. But so getting back to our scenario, we're on our liamspizza.com UI, which is a single page application that's trying to access a API resource at api.liamspizza.com.
Yeah.
So let's say you want the menu, right? Although the menu would be public. So, you know,
I want to order something.
Yeah, you probably would allow people to order anonymously as well. But let's say hypothetically, all right, let's say you want the list of all orders placed within the last half hour.
Yeah.
Right. Or all pending orders, because let's say you're actually the shop and you need to make those pizzas, right? So pending orders, you want to call the pending orders API. So you make that request from your browser's code makes that request to the orders API endpoint at api.liamspizza.com. And along with it sends that access token. That access token is sent as a header, mm-hmm. an HTTP header, specifically called an authorization header, using a scheme called the bearer scheme, right?
Yeah.
What that means is you put it in the authentication header and you put the word bearer with a space before your token, and that's the value of that header.
Yep. Yeah.
You don't have to use that. That's typically what you do. You don't have to use that scheme. You could use a different scheme, but that is ostensibly how it works. So your API receives that token, okay? And it does a bunch of things. The first thing it does is it says, who was this token issued by? And it can say, okay, well, it was issued by this authority. Mm-hmm. It can say, well, how do I know that it was issued by that authority? Well, it can call that authority's metadata
endpoint and get the list of keys, and it can validate that that token was signed with one of the keys from that authority.
Sure.
So your API is configured to trust that authority, right?
Yep.
Now, if I try and call your API with a token issued by any random authority, unless I've configured my API to trust that authority, that request is going to fail. It's going to not be authorized.
Mm.
Now, confusingly, that's a 401 in HTTP, which means not authorized.
Yep.
But that actually means not authenticated, right? So from authentication / authorization position, that means not authenticated. But technically, the meaning of that code 401 is not authorized.
Sure.
For actually not authorized, meaning you are not authorized to do this, you get 403, which is forbidden. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So in this scenario, you have a token. It's an access token. It's issued by an authority that the API trusts. The next thing it does is it sees, well, what is the audience on this token? And if that audience is not itself, you get 401. You're not authorized. Now, in that case, you actually are not authorized because you kind of are authenticated. And this is where it gets a bit blurred, right? But you would still get a 401 because the authentication request would fail. But let's say you have your token and it's issued by the authority that your API trusts. The audience is the audience that the API is configured and recognizes as itself. Well, that request is now authenticated. And your API will then process that request and respond accordingly.
Yeah.
Now, you may have internal logic around authorization, right? So for example, as I said, you can pass user claims in your access token. So that access token may also include information about the user.
Mm-hmm.
So it may say, who was this issued to? And that might say Matt. And your API might say, Matt doesn't work in the kitchen. This is a 403. Or it might say it's Liam. And your API says, yep, Liam is the chef. And here is the data you asked for. Or you might even encode those roles into the token so that the API doesn't even have to look up who you are. It just says, this is the roles that this person has. I trust this authority.
You're sure.
Because, you know, another thing you can do, this is way off topic here, right? But as part of your authentication process, your authority can actually call your API to get information about the user and use that to enrich that token with claims specific to your application.
Yep.
That's kind of off topic a little bit.
Now, this is interesting because this is something that's confused me in the past.
Yeah.
And the idea of identity and users.
Yeah.
Right. My application, do I need a user table if I have an external identity server?
It depends.
Exactly. And that's why I wanted to bring this up, right? And now I think this is kind of what you just highlighted there was it's up to your use case. Does my application store its own view or version of the users and their roles and what they can access and their local and all the information relevant to them? Or do we use our identity server? And I'm not talking specifically about the product identity server, but the concept of an identity server as our database for users and a small subset of what claims that they can have around roles and certain things like that.
Yeah. So there is an answer to that question. And this is my opinion, but I feel like it's an opinion that I hold quite strongly, and I'm happy to change it if someone can convince me otherwise. But authorization is an application level concern,
mm-hmm.
right? So let's say you've got single sign-on and you've got an identity provider that you're an authority that you're managing. And let's say you're in a large enterprise. Let's say this isn't even a public facing thing, but let's say you've got 1,000 applications all using this authority.
Yep.
If you make authorization an authority level concern, that means your authority now has to manage authorization and know about the internals of applications for 1,000 different applications.
Yep.
And that's not the right place for that. The right place for that is within those applications themselves.
Yep. So application admins can manage that access and that authorization. Yep.
Yes. Yeah. But also, you know, like what I can do at Liam's Pizza is a concern of Liam's Pizza, not a concern of my authority.
Sure.
So for that reason, if your application has distinct users and roles, those users and roles should be in your application.
Mm-hmm.
But your application may not need distinct users and roles. It may just need to know, is this person allowed to access this data?
Yeah.
And that may be it, right? You know, in that case, no, you don't need a users table in there at all.
And I guess that's why it's not a prescriptive approach, is it? It's exactly. You need to really look at what your use case requires.
Yeah.
And by all means, you may not need the infrastructure for storing users and maintaining users on your side.
Yeah.
And if you don't, then it's not a bad thing to rely on your authentication authority to handle that for you.
Yeah. It's horses for courses, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Or as we like to say, it depends.
So I just wanted to make that point because it's something that's Oh, no, it's confused me in the past.
Yeah.
As to if I've got an external authority, do I really need users in my application?
Yeah.
And it depends. Who's the source of truth? How do you synchronize that data? How do you make sure that they're all up to date?
That's a really good question. And that's a really good question. That's another topic, right? So synchronizing data between these different things and the source of truth is a whole topic on its own. There is something called SCIM, which is the System for Cross Information Management. Oh, I don't know. I need to look that up. Cross-system information management. There's other things as well, but there's different ways of means of managing that. And that is a whole other topic, right? Nevertheless, I personally feel that if your application has, as part of its domain model, users and roles and permissions, then that information belongs in that application.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of that application's domain.
I completely agree with that. Sorry, SCIM, System for Cross-Domain Identity Management.
That's the one. Yeah. That's specifically a protocol for syncing these things between, you know, these different systems. And, you don't necessarily always need to do that because, like I said, you can enrich that token during login using the application itself as the source of truth. But again, this is off topic, right? I want to keep talking about this authentication process. So we've spoken about what happens. You go to liamspizza.com, you log in, you go to the authority, you log in, you get redirected back with the code. The code is exchanged for the tokens. We've already spoken about the profile scope, which gets you the identity token, the API resource specific scope, which gets you the access token. And I also spoke about another scope called offline access, which gets you a refresh token.
Yes.
Do you know what that's for?
For refreshing your authentication token.
Correct. Yeah. So what you can do... So refresh tokens are a bit different to the identity token and the access token in that they are not JWTs. They are 100% proprietary. Any identity provider or authority can do whatever they want as a refresh token. It could be a GUID, right? It would be inadvisable, but it could be a GUID, right? It's not human readable and, you know, there's no human readable payload in it. And what the refresh token is used for... Oh, so actually the other thing that I mentioned is that that access token has an expiry time. Mm. So the other thing that is happening when your API validates that is it's making sure it's current, right? That it hasn't expired. So it has to trust the authority. It has to not have been tampered with. It has to have the correct audience and it has to not have expired. So what happens if your token is leaked, your access token is leaked? Now, I said that the authorization code is valid for a single origin,
mm-hmm.
but the access token isn't, right?
Mm.
It's even if you causes a browser concern, right? There's nothing stopping me using the access token from a completely different domain and using like Postman or curl, right?
Yeah.
So one way to mitigate that is with short-lived tokens. So tokens are generally, access tokens are generally an hour, 3,600 seconds. I mean, that's typical. They can be longer lived, they can be shorter lived, but typically they would be an hour. So what happens if I'm using this application and I log in and I get a token and an hour goes by and that token has now expired, well, then I've got to log in again. And that's
not desirable.
That's not desirable. So to mitigate that, you get a refresh token. So what I can do is I can look at the expiry of my token. And before I make a request, if my token is going to expire within the next 60 seconds, I can use that refresh token and I can call my authority and say, hey, can I have a new token? And I can do that on the behalf of the user without the user having to manually log in again.
Yep.
Or if the cookie is also long lived, you know, it could just be a case of clicking the login button and the user will just, you know, see the page refresh and then they're logged in. What's actually happening is they're redirecting to the authority because they've got a cookie. They don't log in again. They come straight back. So, and that's going to be important for later on, but you can avoid even that with a refresh token. You just call the token endpoint and you say, give me new token. So then you get a new access token that is valid for another hour, expires an hour again, and a new access token. Now, this is not prescribed, but this is 100% how you should be doing it, is you should get a new refresh token as well. So every time the refresh token is used, it should be no longer usable, and you should get a new one. But that is actually an individually configurable thing. That is not prescribed by OIDC, but that is absolutely what you need to be doing.
Yep.
Okay, so I think we've got a good handle on how this all works. But here's a question for you. What happens when I close my browser because I go to lunch or it's the end of the day and then I come back after lunch or the next morning and I open my browser and I want to start using the application again? Let's say it's not Liam's Pizza. Let's say it's, you know, Goldie CRM 3000 or whatever, right? Some internal enterprise application or what have you, right? Whatever, right? What then?
I don't want to log in again.
No, you don't. Let me tell you, right? We are now about to tackle the biggest question and the biggest area of confusion around how to handle JWTs in single page applications. This is the area that most people are confused. And let me explain why. What a lot of people will do is they will get their access token and their refresh token, or their ID token, doesn't matter, and they'll save them in local storage in the browser, right? That's not secure. Don't do that.
Yep.
Okay. Now, I think a lot of people are doing that. I think most people at this stage are aware of the advice, that's not secure, don't do that.
But no one's aware of what the alternative is.
That's right. Or very few people. And this is where I see, and this is why we're now at the guts of why I wanted to talk about this, and why I asked you the question earlier when I said, what's stopping you doing that with a cookie with your single page application? So let's get into it, right? So you come in the morning or after lunch, you don't want to have to log in again. Well, there's one simple way of getting around that, right? And that is, well, you don't have to actually log in again because you already have a cookie for your identity provider. So yes, you're going to have to click the login button, but you're just going to click the login button and then immediately be logged in for all intents and purposes. What's actually going to happen is you're going to bounce across to your identity provider, your authority, immediately bounce back, and your browser is going to send the authorization code and get a token. All that's going to happen in under a second, right? So you're going to click your login button and you are going to bounce across to your identity provider. You're going to bounce back and you're basically going to click the login button and you're going to be logged in.
Yep.
So that UX isn't terrible, right? To avoid the security hazard of saving those tokens in local storage, that's not bad, but it can be made better. Now,
if I don't have to click the login button,
wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
So there is something that we're going to talk about in a moment, right? Which is called the BFF pattern. That stands for backend for front end. This is the actual quote unquote way of solving this problem. Now, I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Now, you don't have to do that. There's a really, really simple, trivial way of solving this problem. And it's this. You don't store the tokens in local storage.
Yeah.
But you store a flag saying this user has previously authenticated.
Yeah.
Then when the user opens your application, you check for that flag and then you programmatically initiate the login.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. So you basically automate that, the click of the login button.
Yes.
On the user's behalf.
Yep.
Yep.
You are assuming that they have a valid cookie for their authority. But that's a pretty safe assumption. And, you know, someone opens the application and 9 times out of 10, they're automatically logged in. 1 time out of 10, they have to log in again with their identity provider. Okay. You know, that's a much better UX than having to click the login button, right?
Yeah. I mean, you could probably just strengthen it by having a last login and store the last login date instead of a flag.
You could. Yeah, you could. And then that's a infinitesimally less complex way than just storing the flag. But yeah, I was saying, you know, there's a really, really simple problem to this solution. When I see this question come up and this discussion come up, that's it. Like, that is the easiest possible way to solve this problem.
I like it. It's nice and clean.
Yeah.
I mean, and if they've logged out of their identity provider, well, they're going to be asked to log back in there anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, you should still have a log out button on your UI, and that will then clear that flag on whatever other data persisted. And then that would then redirect you to the log out page on your identity provider, so you can log out there as well. But again, they're two separate things. So that's kind of a neat solution to that problem. And you know, if you do nothing else, stop saving your tokens in local storage and just do this. Okay. Now, let's go back to the very start, right? Now, I asked you, why can't you just do that cookie thing with your single page application? We've actually already kind of touched on why you can't do that. And that is because of this same origin thing.
Yep.
So a cookie is only valid for one origin, right? So a website or a web server issues a cookie, and that cookie is then sent on all requests to that web server.
Mm-hmm.
So what if I log in and I go to my identity provider and I come back and I then send my access token to my API. My API says, cool, here's a cookie.
If your API is on the same origin,
you can do that. So we were speaking earlier about how liamspizza.com might be the UI and api.liamspizza.com might be where the back end is. But it's also common for the API to just host the UI. You know, if we think about what we used to do with the single page application templates in .NET, that single page application UI would be hosted by the API.
Yeah.
So you absolutely can do that in that scenario.
I've done that too in the past, where you've got the single page app is just hosted at the root, and then you just have a virtual, in iOS, you have a virtual directory for the API underneath it, that's slash API.
Oh, yeah, it's at /API. Yeah, so it's the same origin, right? So the
same origin.
The host.
You just have a virtual directory of API under that.
Yeah, you can do that. Yeah. I mean, you don't even have to do that, right? Because the UI will proxy to the API, right? So the UI knows what its routes are, and the vice versa as well. The API knows what routes it has, and it will proxy requests to the API. Or, you know, if you have that API prefix in the URL, you can do it that way without using a separate virtual directory, because you might not be hosting on IIS, right?
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. I guess this allowed sort of a separation of the code bases too. And
yes. Yeah. You can absolutely do that. If you have your UI and your API, or your resource, your API resource, your protected resource, and your client on the same origin. And by same origin, we mean the host yep. part of the address has to match. So yep. not, you know, not a different subdomain, but the whole host part. So the yep. bit between the https://// and the very next slash, that yep. part is your host. If that's the same, you can absolutely do that. There's mm-hmm. nothing stopping you doing that. Now, the BFF pattern takes it a step further, right? So the BFF pattern does more than that. What happens is you log in and you get your token, you make your request to the back end. The back end saves that token securely, not in the browser, in encrypted storage somewhere, and issues you a cookie. That back end, that BFF, that back end for the front end. Sorry, I should have mentioned that's what BFF. Did I mention that's what BFF stands for? Yeah, back end for front end. So that back end for the front end is then responsible for refreshing those tokens on your behalf. Now, if we're talking same origin, that's not necessarily, it doesn't really matter. But what the BFF does, if you've got, say, your UI at some address and your API at another address, well, the way that the BFF works is the BFF serves your UI
yep.
and makes proxied requests to the back end. So I log in, I get my access token. My UI, instead of making a request to my API, makes a request to my BFF.
Yep.
My BFF issues my UI a cookie. That cookie is then sent automatically on all requests to the API, to the BFF. The BFF then uses that token, which it retrieves from its secure storage, so Key Vault if it's online or encrypted in the database, whatever, and then makes those requests to the back end using those tokens. Automatically rotates the cookies, updates them, automatically refreshes the tokens when needed. And this is the quote unquote proper way of doing this. Now, if your UI is served from your API, there's nothing stopping your API and the BFF being in the same host.
Sure.
And, you know, arguably, do you even need those tokens? Well, you do for that UX issue we spoke about earlier, right? So with that, you don't need that trick of have they logged in before, because, you know, you've got the cookie, right?
There,
you know, or the backend has the tokens, right? The BFF has the tokens. So, you know, you kind of mitigate that by removing that step for having to have them be automatically logged in, because they just are. So that kind of, in a nutshell, is how BFF works. And, you know, with cookies, you do need to do a couple of things to protect them, because obviously they're susceptible to all kinds of things. There's like cross-site request forgery. And the way that you mitigate that is with same site. So a cookie can be marked as a same site cookie. And that means that it's only ever sent to the site that issued it, which is kind of how it should work anyway. The other thing is it can be marked as HTTP only, which means that it's sent to the site that issued it along with every request, and nothing else. It's not accessible from JavaScript, essentially. Sure. Right. So that then mitigates all those different attacks. But essentially, you have your cake and eat it, right? And that kind of
answers. Yeah, you have your cookie and eat it.
You have your cookie and eat it. Yeah, very good. You have your cookie and eat it. Yeah, you're right. You know, you still use your cookie, because even though everyone's doing JWTs, and like you said, for the past 5 years or so, or however many years, that's kind of been the, longer than that, 10, whatever it is, that's been the standard. But cookies are still there, and cookies are still part of the standard, and they're still part of that process. So yeah, just to repeat that and just to wrap up, right? If your UI and your protected resource are on the same origin, you can literally just have that back end issue a cookie and, you know, be done with it. You probably still want the BFF pattern because you want to manage those tokens, but you don't have to. Yeah. If they're not on the same origin and they're not on the same host, then you can use a standalone man in the middle, for want of a better word, BFF. And that then serves the UI and issues the cookie. And that manages the tokens securely. And that's how you get the best of all worlds. And that's how you combine cookies and tokens and have your cookie and eat it.
Awesome.
Without having to store your tokens in local storage. Don't do that.
It's interesting, because you see a lot of places when you're looking at this kind of stuff, you do see it written everywhere. Do not store the token in local storage. Do not store it in local storage. But nowhere have I seen where it gives you an alternative.
Yeah.
So it just says, don't do this, but they never say, here's another, the better way to do it. that I've seen anyway.
And that's it. And I think that's really why I wanted to do this episode. And as I said, I've been planning a series of videos on this. I want to explain in a bit more detail what we've been talking about this evening about Auth and how it works. But yeah, like you said, I see it everywhere as well. I see everyone saying don't store your tokens in local storage. Well, where do I store them then? It's just like crickets, right?
Yeah.
So, but that information is out there. It's just never in the same documentation. It's never immediately following the big red warning saying don't store your tokens in local storage.
Yeah. And I'm going to, because I like to do this, I want to loop this back to previous episodes, right? And I seem to try to do this in every episode. And I think the point to here is, a couple of episodes ago when we were talking about, are we wrong about everything?
Yeah.
The point I made towards the end there was, it's not that we're wrong about everything, but it's understand why we do things the way we do them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And here, what you've just described in reality isn't as complicated as it sounds if you understand why those certain aspects of the system are in place.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Why do we have the access codes? Why do we have the authentication tokens? Why do we have the refresh tokens? Why do we have the authentication cookies? Right. Why do we have cores? When you actually, if you look at it from a holistic point of view, it's a very complicated mess of things. And to be able to just sit there and to take it for granted, oh, well, this is the way we must do it, it is quite daunting. And then you get that question of where do I store my cookie? Oh, where do I store my token?
Yeah.
Do I store it in local storage? No. Well, and no one's telling me where.
Yeah.
But again, if we dig in and we don't just take everything for their face value, but if we start to really interrogate why are we doing things this way, it sort of starts to add clarity to the whole story.
I think so. And I think, again, just to loop it back and what we've been speaking about this evening, and again, with what you said about that episode, Are We Wrong About Everything, which currently was the most recently released episode, but by the time this is released, won't be. You know, perhaps the better question is, are we taking everything for granted?
Well, look, listening to you explain the entire Auth story, and particularly towards the end there with the BFF and whatnot, the first thing that goes through my head is this surely this is not the simplest way to do it? Like, why are we overcomplicating it? Why is it done this way?
Yeah. I mean, I did offer you a much simpler approach before that.
Just cookie auth?
No, which is just have a flag.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, but even then, like, I mean, if you think about the flow of information, the flow from me clicking the login button on my website or on your website, which then redirects me to your identity provider, which I then either have to log in on or I'm already authenticated on, which then sends back to the request the authorization token, which then gets sent back to get me my authentication token, which then we use to authenticate everything. But then when my requests go back to the server then needs to go back to the identity provider to get its public keys to verify the signature of my token.
So it's actually only ever going to do that the first time.
And it's going to cache it locally, right?
Yeah.
But if you think about all those steps, like, that's a lot of steps going ahead. And I only got halfway through that story.
It is. And, you know, again, just to go back to what you were saying a minute ago, which is that it all seems, before you start interrogating it and asking why and picking apart and looking at these, it seems like a huge complicated mess, which is what you said, I think. But again, looping it back even further to 2020, I believe, NDC 2020, there was a fantastic talk offered by a young, handsome gentleman titled How to Eat an Elephant.
Yep. Yeah, I'm trying to think about what you're talking about there. Well, and I think that's it, right?
Yeah.
You take it apart piece by piece.
Yep.
And look, honestly, if we want to break it apart, the easiest solution is to have a table in your database with a username and a password. Don't worry about encrypting it. Just shove it in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not solid advice, obviously, but that's, I say that tongue in cheek just to make the point that we kind of have to get to a point now where what we've got now, because of all the breaches that are happening or have happened, are happening. And this is what we have to do these days to make sure that everything is secure, to make sure that our data is secure, that people can't access well, I mean, and we haven't even spoken about locking down individual resources and your entire security posture. All we've spoken about here is your authentication authorization side.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. There's a whole heap that we can go on further. But I guess the point I'm trying to make here is, yes, it is complicated and it's complex, but I think that's just by necessity nowadays.
I agree. I do think it's complex. I don't know if it's complicated, but it is complex. But I also think, again, like what I've tried to do and hopefully succeeded at is demystify it. And yes, it is complex and there's a lot of moving parts. But when you break it down, it is all quite understandable. You know, like, I mean, look, there is, I was going to say there's no black magic in there. The internals of how like an authority works, yes, you know, in terms of how you're, you know, the algorithms of how you're signing things and how you're issuing tokens. And that's what Identity Server does, by the way, is handles all that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to oversimplify it. You know, yes, there's a lot of complexity and complicated things in there. But in terms of like the high level understanding of the process and how it works, I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's that hard. But again, going back to another, looping it back again, something else we've spoken about, I can't remember which episode it was, but we were talking about how you don't need to be an expert in everything. Like everything that we've spoken about, you know, if anyone's listening to this and listening all the way through, it's because they're interested.
Yep.
But you don't have to be. Like if you want to just take it, you know, on faith that it works and that you're doing the right thing because that's what everyone says, that's kind of okay too, yeah. Right? If you're following the best practices and you're doing the right things, you don't have to know how it works. You know, you don't have to peel back the covers and look inside that black box. You can just be comfortable with that being a black box and focus on
absolutely
the complexity in your domain if that's, you know, what you're more interested in.
Absolutely. I just want to loop this back one more time. Just one more loop before
there are more loops in these loopbacks than the complexity in that authentication process.
One more loop back, right?
Yeah.
So towards the end there, you're talking about the, I guess, the architecture of your solution with the SPA stuff. The,
I was going to do it if you weren't.
API, but you your APIs, your BFF, right?
Yeah.
Now that's, I guess, taking into account the entire architecture of your application.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be awesome if there was a conference around that we could actually discuss and talk about this kind of architecture?
Well, and you know, and design.
And design.
And then kind of analyze those things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a kind of architecture, design, and analysis conference.
And I think somewhere in Melbourne in November would be pretty awesome.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wouldn't it also be awesome if you could get 15% off your ticket just by listening to us waffle on?
Look, I'd love to get 15% off my ticket.
Yeah.
But to do that, I'd jump onto adaconf.org, which is, as we were saying, Melbourne, November 8th, the Analysis, Design and Architecture Conference. And if you drop in the code BDD15, you'll get 15% off.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said last time, look, I'm looking so forward to it. I'm looking forward to catching up with people so much so that I'd love to shout someone a ticket.
Yep. Amazing.
And I said the last episode, I did say the end of November, but end of October.
Yeah.
But I do know this episode will be released on the 30th of October, which is just a week and a half before the conference.
Yeah.
So I reckon if we say anyone that likes and shares, that can prove that they've subscribed to one of our feeds, reshares one of the tweets or one of these social media posts that we put out before, say, the 3rd of November, so the Sunday, the 3rd of November, you and I will jump on our call and we can record it and we'll see if we can draw out someone who can be available in Melbourne on the 8th.
Maybe we can live stream it.
Yeah, sounds good.
Awesome. That's very generous, Liam.
Oh, look, I'm really looking forward to it. Can't wait.
Yeah. Oh, we also, you know, what we also need to do is we need to figure out where the BDD beers are going to happen.
I know. Yeah. I don't know if you know, but I lived in Melbourne for about 9-10 months once.
I didn't know.
A while back. Down, yeah, that was good fun, but wasn't for me. But no, if anyone knows of a good brewery, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Yes. Or somewhere nice to drink, somewhere we could drink. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe Chris will have something lined up.
Yeah. I mean, well, I know we're planning on being down there the Thursday night beforehand.
Yeah.
And staying that Friday night. So if anyone wants to catch up, that'd be awesome.
Awesome. Cool. Well, I feel like I have just unloaded a whole massive lot of hot air on you and on our audience. So I'm excited for ADA Conf. But for now, I think that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs. I'm Matt Goldman.
I'm Liam Elliott. Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Nicole.
You better be recording that.
The recording just started just after I... I want to get technical.
Ready?
Let's go.